executive discussion.
Oh, we got work sessions, Blue Sky.
Okay, find out when they're gonna be here. Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. We're opening a public hearing on House Bill 5034, Public Employees Retirement System. You're back up, Mr. Roadman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stenner Hayward, members of the committee. For the record, Steve Roadman, Executive Director at PERS. Today, what we're going to cover are a couple of required reports, one dealing with earnings crediting and the other dealing with the PERS health insurance program. And I also wanted to provide you an update on the budget notes and other special allocations that were made to PERS over the 1315 biennium to let you know how we were progressing on those. So, going to page 58 of the presentation, just a list of the areas that we're going to do our reporting on relating to the POPs that were approved last session, as well as some of the other directives out of the legislation, Senate Bill 861 and 822. Central data management was an allocation out of the 1315 session dealing with the need to consolidate and better manage the data that we have within our agency. So there you see the progress that we have made in the expectations or directives that we were accomplishing in that initiative. There is still quite a bit of money to be spent in this biennium. You see the projected expenses of over $300,000. That's because we're in the process of selecting the tool that we will be using for this initiative, and we haven't purchased it yet, or it hasn't hit the budget process yet. But we will within this biennium, and that will be the big hit to those projected expenses. And we will leave some $72,000 on the table, as it were, at the end of that project. So this is a organizational change for our agency in centralizing where data is derived for all the different business purposes that we're using. That's why this is progressing rather deliberatively through our process in this biennium.
Mr. Roadman, just to clarify, but you expect that you will have expended that additional $315,615 by the end of this biennium?
That's correct, Co-Chair.
Thank you.
The next report is on our storage area network. This was to replace our old storage area network to keep up with the growth of our business data and also to provide options and solutions for our future business requirements. So this project is completed. We purchased the new storage area network for less than what was allocated in the POP, and it's currently operational. The next area I wanted to explore is the IAP. We talked quite a bit yesterday about phase three as the POP that we have to work in the 15-17 biennium. Phases one and two are ongoing in this biennium, so phase one is completed. Phase two is in process, but to be completed by the end of 13-15, and then again, phase three will commence after July 1 should this POP that we requested be approved. So, this is again a project in process, and I will allow that there is a special challenge to any agency with an IT project relating to making sure we are staying on track and performing well, and that our respective agency oversight from DAS and LFO oversight are getting the information they need about that progress. So we've been working very closely with Mr. Borden and other folks in the LFO office to make sure that they know the progress we are making in the project, and we're following the stage gate process in doing those reports and making sure, of course, that DAS is also on board with our progress in this project. The mechanics of that have needed to be worked out as we've gone along. We will own that we didn't perhaps copy as many people as we needed or involve as many people as we needed in the distribution of that information. So we're correcting that as we go forward and fill those gaps. It does, though, to me, demonstrate the need to continue our close association with LFO staff and DAS on any of the policy option packages we have relating to technology. So one of the points I didn't make yesterday, I want to underscore today, is that if those policy option packages we've asked for relating to technology in the next biennium are approved, we certainly want to work with LFO staff on how we stay connected on progress on those projects, what milestones they will want to see us accomplish as we move through the next biennium, and staging of the funds being released through the course of that biennium as those milestones are met. So we want to make sure, as Mr. Borden has schooled me well, that the legislators want to know what they're buying when they give us the authority to spend money. We want to make sure that you know we're spending it on what you wanted us to, and that we're spending it well. So we'll stay connected through the next biennium in those reports, and expect, should those POPs be put forward for approval, there will be a reporting component to that that we need to pay very close attention to. The only other element to bring up to speed on in the IEP piece is one of the struggles we had in getting going on it was to make sure that we had a quality assurance component that was driven by DAS to make sure we have independent oversight on that project. And that's in process, and the first review that's been completed, everything on the project is proceeding fine. But it did take a while to get the procurement for that QA service up to speed, but that's in place now. So we expect more full reports through the course of this biennium on phase two, and then of course we'll incorporate further oversight by QA in phase three. Senate Bill 861 had a fiscal impact statement associated with changing the way that we calculate COLA, and also with the supplementary payments that were approved as part of that. So this is a report on our budget dollars and actual expenses. Again, we're under budget, and we executed these requirements. We changed the COLA payment structure in 2014 and to comply with Senate Bill 861 and the further refinement that was in 822. And also we sent the supplementary payments out in November to all of the benefit recipients that were entitled to that. So it was a good project to get under our belt, the supplementary payment process. Also, this being our first time through it, we have some improvements that we'd like to make to that process. That's where you see still some projected expenses to come on this, because we have some lessons learned on how we pulled the information, did the calculation, processed the payments. We're going to implement some of those changes before the end of the biennium. So next fall, when this rolls around again, we'll do an even better job in getting those out on time. So that's what happened with 861 and 822. Again, dealing with the tax remedy piece, combined with our interface with Department of Records to create a batch job that turned those tax remedy payments off in 2014 for a large number, some 16,000 of our members. And then every year we have to re-engage with DOR to make sure that people moving into the state or out of the state have, we capture that change in residency. So again, under budget on this requirement and executed the project through this biennium. We now have the process in place to do the tax remedy job as we've envisioned it, so there are no more projected expenditures. We've got the functionality well in line. So the budget note reports, to move on for out of Senate Bill 5537, which was our budget bill last year. We were to submit a budget report on the impact of the 2013 legislation on employer rates for 1315. We completed that in August of 2013, where we reported to LFO that the impact reduced overall employer rates by 4.4% of payroll. And when we reported that in August of 2013, that was some of that reduction had to do with the benefit reductions under the cost of living, and then also we were asked to defer some of the increase into a later biennium. When 861 was adopted in September of 2013, that further reduced benefits such that we did not defer any of that increase anymore. So it was a full 4.4% reduction in cost, not partial reduction and partial deferral. So that set us up for the 2015-17 rates, what were based on those full cost reductions from both Senate Bill 822 and 861. The other report we have is a budget that we had was a health insurance report that will go into more detail later as a work session item. And then we're also asked to report quarterly and annually on our retirement activity. So every quarter we provide a report to LFO on the number of retirements we had, broken out by the tiers that we have as in our membership, as well as the actuarial groups that those retirements came from. And then we have a cumulative annual report that kind of rolls up those four quarters, and we provide those again every quarter to the LFO staff as the data becomes available.
Mr. Rubin, on the Senate Bill 822, I thought that, perhaps I just didn't understand your comments on it, but I thought that the work that was done in the special session on PERS reform negated that 1.9% of covered payroll rollback.
Co-Chair Stenner here, Senator Whitsitt, it did, and I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. I was trying to make the comparison that when we gave that report in August 2013, the special session hadn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. So the report says it's 2.5% for cost reduction, 1.9 deferral. When 861 was passed in September of 2013, that 1.9 was no longer a deferral, it was actual cost reductions.
Thank you.
So that's the rest of the material I was going to present today, other than to participate in the work sessions on the reports that you have.
Ms. Brickman, you did all of your stuff yesterday. You're good to go? Okay. Committee, any more questions specifically related to the public hearing aspect of this? Okay. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5034. And do I have to open separate work sessions for each of these? Okay. I'm going to open a work session on the PERS 2014 Preliminary Earnings Crediting Report. You're back up.
Thank you. So we are required every year as part of our earnings crediting to process to report to the Ways and Means Committee on our preliminary decisions for the prior calendar year. So what happens every year is we have an accumulation of earnings on the PERS fund. And then annually, we take those earnings and allocate them to the various accounts and reserves that we have within PERS. So there are some elements of that that are discretionary. In other words, some elements that are that the board can decide how much to allocate. And there are some that are driven by statute. So what you see in this slide is an allocation in accordance with those areas where the PERS board had some discretion to allocate the earnings from 2014. Other elements like the health insurance accounts, for example, get their own earnings. So those rates are different and outside of the board's discretion. The other point that I would note is these 2014 earnings that are allocated are net of the administrative expenses of the agency, as well as any fees and costs that are incurred by the Treasury in managing the PERS fund that are taken off the top of the earnings available for crediting. So this is a net earnings figure, net of those administrative expenses. Starting at the top, we have a contingency reserve, which is established by statute, which for which the board can choose to allocate expenditures out of that contingency reserve for things like resolution of issues that come up from time to time. And the most recent example was one where we had a staff error in implementing a statute that resulted in some final average salary adjustments that needed to be made. Rather than make all of those adjustments because they were so relatively small, we allocated $6.5 million out of the contingency reserve in put that into the benefits and force reserve so that the employers were held harmless from the cost of that error. That contingency reserve can only be funded in circumstances in a year where we exceed earnings above the assumed rate. Our assumed rate is 775 for 2014. We did not exceed 775 in net earnings for 2014. So the board has no discretion as far as making an allocation of earnings to the contingency reserve. Instead, that contingency reserve balance is going to carry forward. I might also note that contingency reserve is where the supplementary payments that were authorized by the 2013 legislature are being paid from. So we expect that to total some $65 to $70 million over the life of the supplementary payment program, and that's where the funding is coming from for those. So that there's obviously more than enough in that reserve to handle those supplementary payments over the course of the cycle that that's to run. Tier 1 member regular accounts are mandated to be credited at the assumed rate. So they received 775 crediting for 2014. As said, our earnings did not reach 775. So we had to supplement the earnings to credit the Tier 1 member regular accounts. We supplement them out of the next line item, which is the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve. This is a reserve that was created as part of the 2003 PERS reforms, where excess earnings in prior years on Tier 1 member accounts are placed so that we have that excess to supplement for years when we do not reach the assumed earnings rate. So you see that we took some, we had to take some funds out of that Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve to supplement the Tier 1 regular member account earnings crediting up to 775, but there were still more than enough earnings on the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve that they received some earnings in 2014. That 1.29% represents those leftover earnings after we bumped up the Tier 1 regular accounts. The next three reserves are grouped together generally in earnings crediting. The benefits and force reserve is the reserve from which we pay member benefits. So when a member retires, we transfer their accounts that are available to support their benefits and employer contributions and earnings necessary to pay for their benefits into the benefits and force reserve. The Tier 2 member regular accounts are those leftover accounts from when members made 6% contributions into their regular accounts, and the employer reserves are the employer contributions and earnings that they are making in accumulation in anticipation of the benefits they will have to pay for in the future. Those three accounts are generally credited equally from available earnings, which is why you see that the earnings rate is the same for those three at 7.25%. It's been the general practice of the PERS board to credit equally across those reserves, more or less giving them the earnings that they generated through the course of the investments in the calendar year. The OPSERP pension program is the contributions from employers for their OPSERP members. That's funded entirely by contributions from members. Again, it more or less gets its own earnings. The reason that its rate is lower is because of the higher relative administrative expenses for that OPSERP program until the base of that fund grows large enough to be similarly proportional to the BEF and the Tier 2 and employer reserves as far as how much administrative expense it can support. Employer side accounts, we talked about how employers make lump sum payments into PERS, and we hold them as advanced payment on contribution. Those employer side accounts receive various contribution rates depending on when they are made, various earnings rates depending on when they are made, and they are also restricted as far as the amount of administrative expenses that can be taken from those employer side accounts. So that's why the rate varies depending on the employer side account in particular. And then lastly, IAP, the individual account program. This is where the member 6% contribution has gone since January 1 of 2004. Again, generally gets its own earnings, but also similar to the OPSERP program, young now, and therefore higher administrative expenses relative to the balance of that account. And that's why the earnings are slightly lower than the 725 that are going to the other accounts. So that's a rundown of the allocation that the PERS board preliminarily adopted in January at their January meeting. We have our next board meeting on March 30th, at which we will adopt final earnings crediting. We haven't heard of any big shift in the numbers. From that I mean, over the course of the last couple of months, we've done some reconciliation with Treasury, as we always do, about how much earnings are available, and we true up some of these account balances. So sometimes these numbers move on the margins. Like instead of 725, it may be 726 or 724, but we haven't heard of any of those lately, and generally this is a good reflection of the earnings allocation that the PERS board will make in its final approval in March.
Yeah,
that was it. Could you, Mr. Redmond, could you talk a little about the sort of the structural deficit we have in that the Tier 1 contingency are no longer creating enough cash flow to pay for the crediting, and I think that's also to some extent true of tier two. So how much is that, you know, how much of that crediting is coming from current workers that is back paying, back filling legacy costs?
Co-Chair Steiner here with Senator Whitsitt. I'm not sure how to answer your question. The Tier 1 regular accounts that you see here are the accounts of active members. As Tier 1 members retire, their account balances are moved into the Benefits and Force Reserve. So those that have already retired, you see their balances reflected in the BIF. The deficit you're talking about, do you mean that historically we haven't earned enough to support the benefit payments that we're paying members? Is that the point you're trying to get to?
I think it's ongoing, but yes.
Okay. Well, the reason we have an unfunded actuarial liability is because if you add all of these accounts up, there's not enough in there to pay for the benefits that are already accrued from the members who have already retired and for members who are yet to retire. And as we covered earlier, 68% of that accrued liability is for retirees and inactives. So the earnings that you talk about on the Tier 1 member regular accounts, if we earn the assumed rate, then those accounts will grow without any sort of drain on other parts of the system. But collectively, these accounts will not generate, are not projected to generate enough to retire the unfunded liability. That's why we have an unfunded liability component of our employer rate, because that's where the PERS board, affecting that benefit formula we talked about, has some discretion to fill that UAL hole. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that these accounts don't have enough in them to pay for benefits accrued today, the contribution rate from employers is going to have to fill that hole over the next 20 years. Okay. And that UAL rate is about 7.25 in the 15-17 rates.
Thank you for that. I'm not sure it got directly, and I probably didn't articulate the question right as I should have, but it's my understanding that the more recent, the contributions being made for the more recent employees in OPSERP and are being used to supplement some of the Tier 1 and Tier 2 obligations. Is that correct or not?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, no, they aren't.
Okay, thank you.
There's the normal cost component of those of the employer rates and contributions. It's the UAL component that is being added on top of active members, that through which that UAL component employers are paying for the shortfall in the system.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions about this?
So, okay. Madam Co-Chair.
I would move
that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you. My co-chair moves that we acknowledge receipt of the preliminary 2014 earnings crediting report. Is there any discussion, Mr. Borden? I should have asked you. Oh, sorry, LFO. I apologize. I mean, BAM, CFO, whoever you are now.
Call me what you want.
Ms. Brickman.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Tamara Brickman with the Department of Administrative Services, Chief Financial Office, and we recommend that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you. We jumped the gun. I apologize. Okay. Now, are there any questions? If not, are there any objections?
LFOs.
LFOs. I'm sorry, Mr. Borden. I asked you earlier, and then you got me all confused about CFO.
LFO recommends acknowledge.
I apologize.
I'm sorry, co-chairs and members of the committee, LFO recommends acknowledging receive the report as well.
Okay. Now that everybody's recommending this, are there still any further questions? And now that I've completely gotten this all backwards.
Well, it's your first work session in a while.
It is our first work session in a while. All right. Any objections? If not, so moved. Representative Comte, do you want to grab this to hold? Do you mind?
Oh, sure.
Thank you very much. Okay. And now I would like to open and I'm closing the work session. I did that. Yeah, so we have to close the work session on the preliminary earnings credit report, opening a work session on the PERS retiree health insurance program budget note report. Back to you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward. So on January 16, 2015, we sent a report to this committee in response to the budget note that we received regarding our health insurance report, our health insurance program. And that report is in the materials on slide 129, but it's oblique. So I'm sorry if you want to read it, you got to turn your computer or something. Anyway, that report does detail our response to the budget note, which asks us to look at how that population in our health insurance program could be served by other aspects of the health insurance environment, like the Affordable Care Act or Cover Oregon. So what we reported on is that we serve two populations through our health insurance program. One population that we serve is what we call the pre-Medicare population. These are members who retire before they're eligible for Medicare coverage, and they choose to use our health insurance program to gain health insurance during that period of time. And that's a small component, a relatively small component of our program. That's about 2,700 members who do that gap filling between the time that they're eligible for Medicare. The vast majority of the people in our health insurance program are acquiring Medicare supplemental coverage. And there, our numbers are 56,621 members who are using our services to acquire that Medicare supplemental coverage. That's the medical coverage itself. There's a dental plan coverage. Another 34,000 of those people also use us to acquire dental coverage. That's maybe why some of the numbers you're looking at don't quite match up, Senator Steiner Hayward. I see the knitted brow. I'm sorry if I'm talking off the wrong numbers.
No, you're good.
Okay.
I was just trying to do some arithmetic in my head, and I wasn't doing a very good job of it. So okay. That was what the knitted brow related to.
So two distinct populations. The one population being the 2,700 or so that use us for pre-Medicare coverage, they could get coverage through the exchange currently. They choose not to. They choose to come through our program. If they chose to go outside of our program to acquire that coverage, they would lose what I would consider subsidies for their coverage that they have through by staying in our program. Statute directs us to create two subsidy programs for public employees. One is for public employees in general, and the other is for state employees. And those subsidy programs generally are applied to reduce the cost of the health insurance coverage that these people acquire. If a member chose to go outside of our plan coverage, we don't pay those subsidies. Instead, they would have to pay the full cost. And the subsidies are for public employees. Generally, it varies depending on your length of service, but it maxes out at $60 a month for public employees in general. For the state employees, there's a different program that basically is supposed to cover the difference between a retired member's health insurance cost and that of an active employee's health insurance cost. We pay a percentage of that difference. The percentage varies, again, depending on your years of service.
That's
so,
for the pre-Medicare
population.
Yeah,
that's
for the post-Medicare population, it's $60 per member per month.
Right.
Which, if I did my, this is where I was getting confused about the arithmetic. I did a little fast arithmetic. So $60 a month times 44,580 people, which is the number that's in the report, times 12 months is $32.1 million a year.
That's the maximum subsidy. I don't know that everybody gets the maximum.
Well, it only requires 8 years of service to get the maximum, so it's got to be most, not
pretty
everybody,
close.
But it's pretty close.
I mean,
so maybe it's $31 million
a
year. And then the part of this, I mean, I guess that the issue to me, the reason we asked you for this report 2 years ago and put this in as a budget note 2 years ago is because, in particular, the pre-Medicare population, and that used to be more of an issue when it was harder to find affordable health insurance if you weren't employed. That is no longer the case with the exchanges available and with Oregon having a pretty robust commercial market in the exchange. And if I'm reading this correctly, do you just need a statutory change in 238.415 to allow that money to be used to buy money on the exchange, or is that not allowed by federal law? I'm a little confused on that point.
Co-Chair Stenner Harrod, so am I. Okay. We've never asked the question. What we have is a trust set up under the federal tax code that we administer to pay that. One of the hurdles in doing this would be the payment processing to be able to pay those subsidies generally to whomever the member chooses instead of just to the health care providers in our plan. So that's an administrative issue we need to correct. The other one I don't know is whether doing that, opening that up, would somehow create a problem under the federal tax code, but we'd be happy to look at that.
I just think it's so frustrating that you guys have to be in the health insurance business on top of everything else when we have some other avenues available to us, and for you to have to figure out.
It's crazy.
I mean, because you can't put them into PAB because they're not public employees anymore. You're basically asking at some level like OMIP used to be, you know, the high risk insurance pool. In a funny way, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, it doesn't seem like a place government should be, doesn't seem like something the state government should be doing. If we want to provide a subsidy, well, that's a decision, although I think if people choose to retire early, that's to some extent their choice too. I'm not entirely clear why it's such a small pool of people. I guess I'm really wondering what you know, and how much are the administrative costs associated with it. Because I don't think that was in your report specifically, how much it costs you to administer all this.
You're right, Co-Chair Stenner Hayward. It's not in our report, and we'd be happy to provide that information. The only caveat, of course, to that is we look at this as a package. So we provide both aspects of that coverage under the same administrative umbrella. I don't think we split necessarily.
But the kinds of insurance that you offer are
different.
Very different.
Yeah.
And so putting out for bid for a regular full spectrum commercial insurance plan is a very different proposition than for a Medicare supplement plan. Am I right?
You know, fair. Yes, you're right. I'm just saying we haven't differentiated. I'm not saying that they aren't two different things.
I mean, I'm okay with this report, all other pieces of it that I struggle with. I'm not sure I'm okay with the fact that you guys are continuing to have to do that, and I think we're going to have to think about that a little bit more personally. It's such a small number of people compared to the number of beneficiaries that we have altogether, and I'm not sure. I mean, maybe we need to look at a phase-out, or maybe we need to look at something, but I'm not super happy with this.
Co-Chair Stenner Hayward, we would be happy to take a look at the tax aspects of it to make sure that we understand if there are any implications there, and also to develop some estimate of the administrative structure that we would have to create to be able to allow us to support those subsidies out to the general marketplace.
Okay, Mr. Borden's trying to show me something while Okay, that sounds good. All right. Okay, other questions? Okay, Ms. Brickman, this time I'm going to do it right.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Tamara Brickman, Department of Administrative Services, Chief Financial Office, and we recommend that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you. Mr. Ward.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, the Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends acknowledging the receipt of the report with the following direction: that PERS return to the interim House and Senate committees on health care and interim joint committee on ways and means in September of 2015 on the feasibility of moving the retiree health insurance premium account population into individual coverage under the Affordable Care Act or other commercially available health plans.
So, Madam Co-Chair, I move we acknowledge receipt of the report and we do it with LFO's recommendation.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Co-Chair has moved that we acknowledge receipt of the report and include LFO's recommendation about reporting back on options to interim committees in September of 2015.
Madam Chair. Mr. Boardman, do you have a rough calculation of what savings, if any, might be available to the state by making that change?
Co-chair and Senator Whitsitt, I do not at this point. I assume it would be part of the feasibility that comes back, the cost-benefit analysis that the agency will bring back. Right now, the administrative cost, that was a question earlier that came up, and our analysis notes that overall for the program, it's about $1.9 million. So for just the administrative portion, not the other costs. So the we assume that there would be good savings with that. But again, this is the smaller part of the population here of this
and that one
of the entire program.
And that $1.9 million includes both populations.
Right.
So it's hard to know, and maybe the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
So we don't know whether the premiums on the under ACA would be less than what the cost here individual then.
Yes, and co-chair and Senator Whitsitt, and one thing too, just to note, the premium costs of the program are $472 million of non-limited funds. So, but we don't know the exact breakout at this point. I think we could find those for you and get back to you relatively in good fashion, short fashion.
$472 million?
$471 million, pardon me, 0.2.
That's the premiums paid by all the participants in the program. And just to be clear,
But PERS itself is not paying $471 million.
Right. I'm hesitating because part of that's the subsidy. The predominant part of that is deductions from benefits.
Right. Okay. So people are choosing to have PERS get their health insurance for them, and they're choosing to allow to have their portion of the premium deducted from their PERS benefit, and then PERS is contributing a certain amount to make up the difference, however that's calculated.
Right.
And that's only for the pre-Medicare population, or that's also for the post-Medicare population?
That's I'm not sure. I think the figure that the LFL staff is quoting is the entire population.
Entire population.
Entire health insurance population.
Poor expenditure limitation.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Senator? Or at least get us as close as we're going to at the moment?
He has me totally confused. That's fine.
Yeah, well, I think we're all rather confused. Representative Nathanson.
Just a small clarification. We will have a report in September 2015. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
And you're cool with that, Mr. Rudman?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Okay. Anything else?
I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify. Yeah. So are you saying that the paying for the insurance, Medicare, and then we have secondary insurance that they're paying for through PERS?
Co-Chair Stanley Hayward, Representative Taylor, the premiums are processed through PERS. The premiums are for predominantly your Medicare supplement coverage because that's the vast amount of our population. Those premiums are funded through either a deduction from the member's benefit and the supplementary pieces that are added on top of that from the insurance trusts we've talked about. So we process $471 million in premium payments on behalf of members who choose to have that coverage. And we pay that then to the insurance companies that participate in our program.
And they can get Medicare in addition?
And then they get Medicare in addition.
Well, I mean, anybody, just to be clear, anyone can purchase a Medicare supplement. I guess, you know, as I sat here and listened to your question, Representative Taylor, it occurred, my husband is a PERS retiree, right? And he's pre-Medicare age. He's not participating in this program because he gets health insurance from me, right? But that means that other people are getting a benefit to some extent that he's not getting and that we're not getting because I'm still paying for, I'm paying the excess, as it were, to insure him out of my paycheck, as it were. So I'm finding this whole pre-Medicare thing problematic, to say the least. The post-Medicare piece is complicated but less problematic since you can't do Medicare through the exchange. But I'm really finding this pre-Medicare piece problematic, to say the least. So we'll look forward to that. Okay, any further discussion? If not, so moved. And is there any other business before? And I'm closing the work session. I'll carry this one to full
Any other discussion before the committee? Oh, Mr. Rubin.
Just one point I wanted to make. We distributed answers to your questions from yesterday. It's already posted to all of us. Just wanted to let you know.
Thank you very much. Anything else before the committee? If not, we're adjourned. Go enjoy a free 45 minutes that you didn't plan on. 45 minutes that you didn't plan on. We're adjourned. Go enjoy a free